The CLE is based on the New York State appellate decisions addressing civil procedure issues that were released in December of 2019. Selected decisions were summarized. The summaries were published on the New York Appellate Digest website in December 2019. And since then, the summaries have been compiled in an update pamphlet. It's that December 2019 Civil Procedure Update pamphlet, which serves as the written materials for this CLE, and the page references are to that pamphlet. The first case is on page 6. It's Mesolingua Associates. It has to do primarily with an appellate issue. Fourth Department, reversing an order concerning whether documents sought in discovery were privileged, noted that the order was appealable as of right. The court said, during discovery, a dispute arose over allegedly privileged documents that plaintiff withheld or redacted. In its privilege logs, plaintiff asserted that many of the documents were protected from disclosure on three grounds. They were material prepared in anticipation of litigation, attorney work product, or they were protected by the attorney-client privilege. Supreme Court granted plaintiff's motion by ordering that all documents of the plaintiff created on and after October 24, 2016 were not discoverable because they were material prepared in anticipation of litigation and the defendants appealed. We reject plaintiff's contention that the order is not appealable. CPLR Section 5701 provides that, with limited exceptions, an appeal may be taken to this court as of right from an order where the motion it decided was made upon notice and it affects a substantial right. An order granting a protective order and precluding discovery of numerous documents affects a substantial right, and the order is therefore appealable as of right. Next on page 7 is Chiaffi versus SM Foods. It has to do with the flexibility surrounding a motion to amend a bill of particulars. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's motion to amend the bill of particulars should have been granted, even though the motion was made after the note of issue was filed and there was no good excuse for the delay. The court wrote, leave to amend a bill of particulars may properly be granted even after the note of issue has been filed, where the plaintiff makes a showing of merit and the amendment involves no new factual allegations, raises no new theories of liability, and causes no prejudice to the defendant. Mere lateness is not a barrier to the amendment. It must be lateness coupled with significant prejudice to the other side, the very elements of the Latches Doctrine. Here, despite their unreasonable and unexplained delay in seeking leave to amend their bill of particulars and interrogatory responses, the plaintiffs did not seek to assert any new theory of liability, but rather sought to narrow a theory previously asserted. Since the proposed amendment was meritorious and sought to narrow the issues before the Supreme Court, the court should have granted the plaintiffs' cross motion for leave to amend their bill of particulars and interrogatory responses as requested. Next is the Fodrell case, which is on page 8. It deals with a motion for a default judgment, but it deals specifically with insurance law. The Second Department held the defendant insurer, Utica, did not meet its heavy burden to demonstrate its insureds, that's JNR's, non-cooperation, such that the insurer was entitled to a default judgment declaring that it is not obligated to indemnify JNR in the underlying personal injury action, in which the injured plaintiff was awarded nearly $700,000. Despite numerous scheduled depositions, JNR's principal, Singh, never appeared to be deposed, and his answer was ultimately stricken. The court said, to effectively deny coverage based upon lack of cooperation, an insurance carrier must demonstrate, one, that it acted diligently in seeking to bring about the insured's cooperation, two, that the efforts employed by the insured were reasonably calculated to obtain the insured's cooperation, and three, that the attitude of the insured after his or her cooperation was sought was one of willful and avowed obstruction. mere efforts by the insurer and mere inaction on the part of the insured without more are insufficient to establish non-cooperation. Utica established, it made diligent efforts through written correspondence, numerous telephone calls, and visits to Singh's home that were reasonably calculated to bring about JNR's cooperation. Utica's submissions, however, failed to demonstrate that the conduct of JNR constituted, quote, willful and avowed obstruction, end quote. So the showing was not sufficient to warrant a default judgment. Next is the De Leon case on page 9. It has to do with the discovery of documents related to an assault in a long-term healthcare facility. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the assailant's medical records were privileged. That's the assailant's medical records. But in any incident reports pertaining to the assault generated by the long-term care facility were not privileged. Plaintiff alleged he was attacked while a long-term resident of defendant long-term health care facility. The assailant in this third-party assault action was not made a party. So the assailant's records were protected by physician-patient privilege. The court said, pursuant to education law, section 6527, subdivision 3, certain documents generated in connection with the performance of a medical or a quality assurance review function, or which are required by the Department of Health pursuant to Public Health Law Section 2805-1, are generally not discoverable. The defendant, as the party seeking to invoke that privilege, has the burden of demonstrating that the documents sought were prepared in accordance with the relevant statutes. Here, the defendant merely asserted that a privilege applied to the requested documents without making any showing as to why the privilege attached. Accordingly, the incident reports related to the assault were subject to disclosure. So the healthcare facility tried to argue that the incident reports were privileged pursuant to the education law and the public health law, but they were unable to demonstrate that those two statutory privileges applied to the facts. Next is Masiti versus Weiss on page 10. It's another discovery case. Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that it was an abuse of discretion to grant defendant's motion to strike the complaint for plaintiff's alleged failure to comply with discovery orders. Discovery had been ongoing for years with several conferences with the judge and several orders to comply with new discovery demands. The court wrote, defendants have provided no explanation as to why they failed to provide any response prior to the filing of defendant's second motion to strike plaintiff's complaint. Although we appreciate Supreme Court's concern regarding the length of time that this action has been pending and the fact that the various discovery responses that plaintiff's counsel did provide were unquestionably untimely, we do not find that defendants have established a deliberately evasive, misleading, and uncooperative course of conduct, or a determined strategy of delay by plaintiff that would be deserving of the most vehement condemnation, and therefore striking the complaint was not warranted despite the delay. Next is Guthart versus Nassau County on page 11. It deals with what a judge can do in the context of determining a motion to dismiss a complaint. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the motion to dismiss plaintiff's declaratory judgment action should have been denied. Supreme Court treated the motion to dismiss as a request for a declaratory judgment in favor of the moving party, the party moving for the motion to making the motion to dismiss. Plaintiff had brought a class action contending that the imposition of a driver responsibility fee on red light camera violations is illegal. The court said, prior to interposing an answer, the county moved, pursuant to CPLR 3211, to dismiss the complaint for failure to state a cause of action. The Supreme Court, treating that branch of the county's motion as one for a declaration in the county's favor, granted that branch of the motion to the extent of declaring that the imposition of a driver responsibility fee on a red light camera violation was a proper exercise of the county's power to charge and collect administrative fees. And based on that declaration, the court directed dismissal of the remainder of the complaint for failure to state a cause of action. And the second department reversed, saying, if the record before the motion court is insufficient to resolve all factual issues, a declaration upon a motion to dismiss is not permissible. So the second department is saying that the motion court simply did not have enough facts before it to convert the motion to dismiss to a motion for a declaratory judgment in favor of the moving party. Next is S&J Service Center on page 12. It's another motion to dismiss, and it deals with the criteria for a pre-answer motion to dismiss based on documentary evidence alone. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant's pre-answer motion to dismiss the complaint alleging the breach of a letter of intent should not have been granted. The evidence submitted by the defendant was not documentary evidence within the meaning of CPLR 3211. The court said the emails and unsigned documents relied on by Supreme Court to conclude that the letter of intent was an unenforceable agreement to agree were not essentially undeniable and did not constitute documentary evidence of the type required by CPLR 3211. Next is Katsouris, which is on page 13. It has to do with the court's power to modify a judgment, in this case, a judgment in a divorce case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the parental access provisions of the judgment of divorce should not have been modified without holding a hearing. The court said, a decision regarding child custody and parental access should be based on admissible evidence. Here, in making its determination, the Supreme Court relied solely on information provided at court conferences and the hearsay statements and conclusions of the family specialist, whose opinions and credibility were untested by either party. So, a judgment may not be modified based on inadmissible hearsay. Next is another case dealing with judgments. Balboa Capital on pages 13 and 14. In this case, it's an out-of-state judgment which should have been given full faith and credit. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that a California judgment should have been given full faith and credit and the underlying merits should not have been considered by the court. The court wrote, absent a challenge to the jurisdiction of the issuing court, New York is required to give the same preclusive effect to a judgment from another state as it would have in the issuing state, and it is precluded from inquiring into the merits of the judgment. Here, the defendants did not challenge the jurisdiction of the California court, but instead sought to relitigate the merits underlying that court's determination. The Supreme Court should not have considered the defendant's attack on the merits of the California judgment. Next is Skutnik on pages 14 and 15. It's a jurisdiction case dealing with a non-domiciliary. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction should not have been granted. Plaintiff demonstrated that defendant had a bank account in a New York bank to which the funds defendant borrowed from plaintiff were wired. Plaintiff alleged defendant had breached a contract requiring the repayment of the loan. The court said CPLR 302A1 is a single act statute, and proof of one transaction in New York is sufficient to invoke jurisdiction, even though the defendant never enters New York, so long as the defendant's activities here were purposeful and there is a substantial relationship between the transaction and the claim asserted. And here the funds that were placed in the New York bank were alleged to have been a loan, and it was alleged the defendant breached the agreement to repay the loan. Next is the Clark Tower case on pages 15 and 16. It's another jurisdiction case, this time dealing with a foreclosure action in another state. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held New York did not have the authority to decide issues affecting title to real property in Tennessee. The court said, plaintiff financed its purchase of the property in 2007 with a note secured by a deed of trust. In 2015, plaintiff and defendant trustee entered into a loan modification agreement. The loan modification agreement is governed by Tennessee law, but requires plaintiff to submit to the jurisdiction of the courts of this state. It does not similarly require defendant to submit to the jurisdiction of this state. Defendant advertised a non-judicial foreclosure sale pursuant to the Tennessee Code based on plaintiff's apparent failure to pay the entire amount due upon maturity. Plaintiff sued, alleging, among other things, breach of the loan modification agreement provision prohibiting the trustee from unreasonably withholding consent to refinancing. The courts of one state may not decide issues directly affecting title to real property located in another state. Although a court with personal jurisdiction over the parties may adjudicate their rights with respect to foreign realty, plaintiffs cite no authority allowing an out-of-state foreclosure sale to be enjoined. Contrary to plaintiff's argument, its one-sided agreement to submit to personal jurisdiction in New York does not confer upon the New York courts a contractual right to enjoin an out-of-state foreclosure sale. Next is the Repwest case, Repwest on pages 16 and 17. It's another jurisdiction case. This time the jurisdiction was removed by statute. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court in this traffic accident case, determined the insurance law required that the matter involving a coverage dispute between two insurance carriers, named Repwest and Hereford, be submitted to arbitration. Therefore, Supreme Court did not have subject matter jurisdiction. The court wrote, pursuant to Insurance Law 5105 Subdivision B, the sole remedy of any insurer or compensation provider to recover on a claim arising pursuant to that statute shall be the submission of the controversy to mandatory arbitration pursuant to procedures promulgated or approved by the superintendent. Contrary to Hereford's contention, since its counterclaim is for loss transfer pursuant to that statute, the counterclaim is subject to mandatory arbitration, and the Supreme Court had no subject matter jurisdiction over the counterclaim. Although Repwest did not seek dismissal of the counterclaim in the Supreme Court, a court's lack of subject matter jurisdiction is not waivable, but may be raised at any stage of the action, and the court may, on its own motion at any time when its attention is called to the facts, refuse to proceed further and dismiss the action. Next is Wells Fargo on page 17. It's law of the case. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the doctrine of the law of the case precluded the court from sua sponte considering whether the notice requirements of real property actions and proceedings law, section 31304, were met by the bank in this foreclosure action. That issue was determined in the bank's favor in the initial summary judgment proceeding and should not have been considered again when the bank moved to confirm the referee's report and for a judgment of foreclosure. Next is matter of Fisher on page 18. It's another case dealing with judgments. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the judgment creditor, Fisher, was not entitled to priority over the respondent wife, Mayray, who had been awarded real property owned with her husband, Julius, in a divorce proceeding. Although Fisher's judgments were docketed, Julius's name was spelled incorrectly, rendering the lien invalid. Although the issue had not been raised before, the appellate court can address it because it's a question of law which could not have been avoided if it had been raised below. The court said, it is undisputed that when the judgments were docketed, Julius's surname was spelled incorrectly. Because the judgments were not docketed under the correct surname, no valid lien against Julius's interest in the subject property was created. Next is Rabinovich on pages 19 and 20. It has to do with the requirement that a certificate of merit be filed in a medical malpractice action, the Second Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Dillon reversing Supreme Court, held 1. The action stemming from alleged negligence in drawing blood donated by plaintiff sounded in medical malpractice, not common law negligence, and 2. Therefore, a certificate of merit was required. Also, the failure to provide a certificate of merit does not warrant dismissal of the action. Rather, plaintiff should be allowed 60 days to provide the certificate. The court wrote, many of the plaintiff's allegations bear a substantial relationship to the rendition of medical treatment to a particular patient. The complaint alleges that the defendant failed to properly screen the plaintiff for health problems, obtain her medical history, monitor her physical condition, measure her hemoglobin levels, and keep her at the donation site for a specific period of time to observe any signs of an adverse reaction. The issues of whether the plaintiff needed additional screening, monitoring, or supervision, and whether she was at risk of falling due to a medical condition, involve the exercise of medical judgments beyond the common knowledge of ordinary persons. Only a medical professional would know what factors make a person ineligible to donate blood, how much blood should be drawn, what constitutes the signs and symptoms of an adverse reaction, and how to immediately treat an adverse reaction. Thus, the interaction between plaintiff and the defendant implicates issues of medical judgment that sound in medical malpractice. Although the complaint was not accompanied by a certificate of merit as required by CPLR 3012-A, dismissal of the complaint is not warranted, as the plaintiff's attorney should be provided with an opportunity to comply with the statute now that it is determined that the statute applies to this particular action. There's no reason to believe from this record that plaintiff's attorney's failure to file a certificate of merit was motivated by anything other than good faith assessment, that CPLR 3012-A did not apply to the action. Only if the plaintiff is recalcitrant in complying with both the statute and this court's order may the Supreme Court, in its discretion, dismiss the complaint. Next is Matter of Mount Olive Baptist Church on page 20. It just stands for the proposition that relief that's not requested in the pleadings cannot be granted. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the motion for a declaratory judgment should not have been granted because declaratory relief was not demanded in the pleadings. Next is Matter of Exxon Mobil Corp., which is on pages 20 and 21. It has to do with service of process and whether the doctrine of equitable estoppel applies to a municipality. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the New York City Department of Environmental Protection, that's DEP, was not properly served with an Article 78 petition, and therefore the court did not have jurisdiction over the Freedom of Information Law action. The process server alleged the petition was delivered to an attorney at the DEP who said she was authorized to receive service. The Second Department found that the doctrine of equitable estoppel, based upon the DEP attorney's assertion she was authorized to receive service, did not apply. The court said, it is undisputed that the petitioner's process server did not deliver the notice of petition and petition to the Corporation Counsel or any other person designated to receive process in a writing filed in the office of the clerk of the New York County. Because the petitioner did not effectuate service in strict compliance with CPLR 311A2, it is irrelevant that the petitioner's process server allegedly relied upon the representations of an attorney employed by the DEP. Contrary to the petitioner's contention, the DEP should not be equitably estopped from asserting the petitioner's failure to properly serve the DEP with notice of petition. There is no evidence in the record demonstrating that the petitioner justifiably relied on any misleading conduct by the DEP, which would support a finding of equitable estoppel. Next is Mighty, the Mighty case on pages 21 and 22. It's another service of process case and another case that involves estoppel. The Second Department held plaintiff was properly granted a second extension of time in the interest of justice to serve the summons and complaint. The court noted that defendant, Ewing, was estopped from contending his address was different from the address indicated in the Department of Motor Vehicles records. The court wrote, since the record demonstrates that Ewing failed to notify the Department of Motor Vehicles of his change of residence, as required by Vehicle and Traffic Law, Section 505, Subdivision 5, he was estopped from raising a claim of defective service. Next, J.P. Morgan Chase on pages 22 and 23, another service of process case. Second Department, modifying Supreme Court, held the time for serving defendant, whose name was Kothari, who lived in India, in this foreclosure action was properly extended in the interest of justice pursuant to CPLR 306-B. But Supreme Court should not have directed an alternative method of service, in this case service upon the defendant's attorney, pursuant to CPLR 308 subdivision 5. The court wrote, Supreme Court improvidently exercised its discretion in granting that branch of the plaintiff's motion, which was pursuant to CPLR 308 subdivision 5, to direct an alternative method for service of process by permitting service upon Kothari's attorney. CPLR 308 subdivision 5 vests a court with discretion to direct an alternative method for service of process when it has been determined that the method set forth in CPLR 308 subdivision 1, 2, and 4 are impracticable. A plaintiff seeking to effect expedient service must make some showing that the other prescribed methods of service could not be made. Here at the hearing, Kothari provided the address where he resides in New Delhi, and the plaintiff failed to submit any evidence that effectuating service in India by any of the authorized methods would have been unduly burdensome. That Kothari resided in a foreign country did not, by itself, relieve the plaintiff of its obligation to make a reasonable effort to effectuate service in a customary manner before seeking relief pursuant to CPLR 308 subdivision 5. Next is Mullen versus Wishner on page 23. It deals with a severance. Second Department held the action against the doctor, Wishner, for medical malpractice was properly severed from an action against the doctor's employer, HMG, for negligent training, supervision, hiring, and retention. Evidence the doctor had negligently treated another patient would not be admissible in the malpractice action, but it would be admissible in the action against the employer. Next is Matter of Civil Service Employees on page 24. It's a case that deals with the issue of standing, in this case, whether the union had standing to sue on behalf of city employees. Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the labor union representing employees of the city's Office of the Building Inspector and Bureau of Code Enforcement had standing to contest an executive order issued by the mayor and related regulations which created a new building department. The court wrote, a petitioner challenging governmental action must show injury in fact, meaning that the petitioner will actually be harmed by the challenged governmental action, and further that the injury falls within the zone of interests or concerns sought to be promoted or protected by the statutory provision under which the governmental entity has acted. For an organization, like a union, to have standing, it must establish that at least one of its members would have standing to sue, that it is representative of the organizational purposes it asserts, and that the case would not require the participation of individual members. Petitioners allege that the mayor unlawfully engaged in a legislative act by creating the building department, and that this unlawful legislative act brought the union's members under the auspices jurisdiction of the commissioner, who used that unlawful grant of authority to enact a regulation that respondents have relied on to supplant the members' negotiated rights regarding disciplinary proceedings as set forth in the applicable collective bargaining agreement. In our view, these allegations would, if proven, demonstrate the requisite harm flowing from the executive order, which would fall within the zone of interests, giving the union standing to bring the suit. Next is Mutual Redevelopment Houses Incorporated on page 25. It's a statute of limitations case, and it involves the continuous representation doctrine in an unusual context. First Department held a negligence action against Skyline, an engineering firm hired to inspect an ongoing heating, ventilation, and air conditioning installation, was not time-barred because the continuous representation doctrine applied to toll the accrual of the limitations period. The court wrote, "Plaintiff demonstrated that the action is not time-barred because the continuous representation doctrine is applicable and tolled the accrual of the statute of limitations until 2014. Plaintiff submitted evidence showing that Skyline provided special and progress inspection testing services for the remediation of Phase 1 of the project, pursuant to a 2014 agreement. Although this work was completed under a separate agreement, Skyline rendered these services to correct the engineering and construction defects that it failed to identify during its Phase 1 inspection in 2012. Since Skyline continued to provide services in connection with Phase 1 in 2014, the action commenced in 2016 is timely under CPLR 214 Subdivision 6. Next on page 26 is Hillary versus Gerstein. It's another statute of limitations case, this time dealing with the continuous treatment doctrine. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court over a dissent, held that the medical malpractice causes of action should not have been dismissed as time-barred. Plaintiff's decedent had seen the defendant psychiatrist for the first time on November 20, 2014, and the next appointment was set up for December 11, 2014. Defendant alleged he called decedent on November 21, 2014, to tell her she should be treated by someone else. But the December 11, 2014 appointment was not canceled. The decedent committed suisicide on November 24, 2014, and the action was commenced exactly 2.5 years later on May 24, 2017. The court wrote, under the continuous treatment doctrine, the period of limitations does not begin to run until the end of the course of treatment if three conditions are met. One, the plaintiff continued to seek and in fact obtained an actual course of treatment from the defendant physician during the relevant period. Two, the course of treatment was for the same conditions or complaints underlying the plaintiff's medical malpractice claim. And three, the treatment is continuous. To satisfy the requirement that treatment is continuous, further treatment must be explicitly anticipated by both the physician and the patient, as demonstrated by a regularly scheduled appointment for the near future. The question here is whether the statute of limitations began to run on November 20th, when the decedent met with the defendant for a medical appointment, or on November 24th, when she died. Since a further appointment was scheduled and was not canceled, further treatment of some sort was anticipated, or at least there is a tribal issue of fact on that issue. So the psychiatrist's motion for summary judgment should not have been granted. There is a question of fact on whether the continuous treatment doctrine applies. Next is Vanyo versus Buffalo Police Benevolent Association on page 27. It's a court of appeals case, but it's a very brief memorandum decision. It has to do with the statute of limitations and also the relation back doctrine. The Court of Appeals, over an extensive dissenting opinion, held that the claims were timely asserted in a complaint which was filed but never served. The amended complaint included the same claims, and therefore the relation back doctrine didn't apply. The court said, "We conclude that plaintiff's first and second causes of action should be reinstated. Those claims asserted in identical form in both the original and amended complaints were timely interposed when plaintiff filed the original summons and complaint, that being when the action was commenced pursuant to CPLR Section 203 Subdivision C and 304 Subdivision A. The relation back doctrine is therefore inapplicable, and it cites CPLR 203F. The takeaway here is that, at least under the facts of this case, the original complaint that was filed but never served constituted a timely commencement of the action. Next is Matter of Plastic Surgery Group, page 29. It just has to do with whether the state seeking medical records needs to have patient authorizations. Court of Appeals, in a full-fledged opinion by Judge Fahey, held that the comptroller of the state of New York, in auditing private health care providers, has the power to subpoena medical records without patient authorizations. The court said the comptroller of the state of New York has a constitutional and statutory duty to audit payments of state money, including payments to private companies that provide health care to beneficiaries of a state insurance program. Here, the comptroller carried out that obligation by means of investigatory subpoenas, Dukas Take, directed to a medical provider seeking patients' records. We hold that CPLR 3122 Subdivision A2 does not require that the comptroller's subpoenas be accompanied by written patient authorizations, as the requirements set out in that paragraph apply only to subpoenas Dukas Tecum served after commencement of an action. Next is Matter of American Express Company, pages 29 and 30, another case dealing with subpoenas. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held a subpoena issued by the Attorney General of the United States Virgin Islands should have been quashed for failure to comply with CPLR 3119. The subpoena failed to meet the procedural requirements for an out-of-state subpoena because it was not issued under authority of a court of record, and it cites CPLR 3119, Subdivision A1, and also Subdivision 4. Although the subpoena need not have been issued in connection with a pending litigation, there must have been some sort of court involvement, such as the issuance of a commission by a state court clerk or signature of the subpoena by a state court judge. We reject respondents' argument that administrative subpoenas are outside the scope of CPLR 3119 and not subject to any restrictions on issuance. Next is Kennedy, the Kennedy case on pages 30 and 31. It has to do with the probative value of a survey map. Third Department, reversing the jury verdict finding that plaintiff had incorrectly set the western boundary of his property, held that the jury was wrongly instructed on the probative value of a survey map. The court wrote, Supreme Court's charge required the jury to locate the western boundary of plaintiff's property as depicted in the 2002 survey unless plaintiff offered evidence that rebutted the survey's presumed accuracy. The jury should have been instructed that, in the absence of contradictory evidence, it was permitted but not required to adopt the western boundary as depicted in the 2002 survey. Hence, Supreme Court committed reversible error because the effect of the charge was to improperly require plaintiff to disprove the alleged accuracy of the 2002 survey map. At this point, I'll insert the verification code for this December 2019 Civil Procedure Update CLE. The verification code is VENUE. Again, the verification code for this December 2019 Civil Procedure Update CLE is VENUE. Next case is Matter of Zelazny, which is on page 31. It's a venue case, Fourth Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice DeJoseph. Held, Supreme Court properly found that Orleans County, not Niagara County, was the correct venue for this hybrid Article 78 declaratory judgment action, which was seeking to invalidate a town local law. The court wrote, Town Law Section 66 Subdivision 1 provides that the place of trial of all actions and proceedings against the town or any of its officers or boards shall be in the county in which the town is situated. We conclude that Town Law Section 66 applies, and as such, the proper venue in the instant action is Orleans County rather than Niagara County. Orleans County is where the town of Shelby is located, and this lawsuit was centered on a Town of Shelby local law. The last case is Onelude versus City of New York, pages 32 and 33. It deals with disclosure of witnesses. First Department, vacating plaintiff's judgment and ordering a new trial in this false arrest and malicious prosecution action, held that the testimony of the defense witness who identified plaintiff as fleeing the scene of a crime should not have been precluded. The name and address of the witness had been provided to the plaintiff 4 years before the trial, and the fact that she had since moved and did not want to disclose her new address to any party was not something the defense could control. The court wrote, "The trial court improvidently exercised its discretion in precluding testimony from the witness who identified plaintiff to the police as an individual she had seen fleeing from the scene of the crime. Defendants satisfied their discovery obligation by providing the witness's last known address and telephone number during discovery more than 4 years before trial. Thus, there could have been no surprise or prejudice warranting the preclusion. While the witness subsequently moved, she declined to disclose her new address to any parties to the suit, a factor defendants could not control. As defendants did not know her new address, they had no obligation under CPLR 3101H, nor should defendants have been sanctioned for the fact that the witness did not wish to discuss the case with plaintiff's counsel when counsel called her. Notably, plaintiff's counsel did not attempt to contact the witness until 2 months before trial and did not attempt to obtain a non-party deposition of the witness during discovery. Defendant offered to have the witness further confirm these facts under oath and outside the presence of the jury. Under these circumstances, the trial court improvidently exercised its discretion in ordering a hearing at which defendant's trial attorney would be subject to questioning by plaintiff's trial attorney and precluding the witness's testimony when defense counsel declined to participate in such a hearing. Given that the witness would have offered highly relevant and non-cumulative trial testimony, the error was not harmless." And that completes this December 2019 Civil Procedure Update, CLE.